Hi everybody, how are you? I hope this finds you well and I hope that you have had a good week. If you are a regular listener, welcome back. If this is your first time joining us, welcome along. It's lovely to have you with us and hopefully you're going to take this moment to dive into one of our 250 episodes and explore the world of soundtracking and listen to some of the fantastic guests that we have had on the show up to this point. We've got so many exciting guests to come. Looking forward to welcoming back some people that have been on already and finally getting people on the show like Mr. Tom Hiddleston, who has been very kind to us and has enthused about us on his social media. So we're thrilled that he's able to join us on the podcast to talk about Loki, but also to talk about loads of other things as well, in particular his own personal journey with music and film. So, yeah, looking forward to sharing that with you. But it's becoming a bit of a thing here on the podcast, having two guests for the price of one. But I'm really pleased to welcome John Krasinski and Marco Beltrami to the podcast, given that A Quiet Place 2 was the first film that I was lucky enough to go and see in the cinema after the most recent lockdown. And I highly encourage you to do the same. It is a film that needs to be seen on the big screen for the full kind of immersive experience. Once again, the latest Quiet Place edition was written and directed by John and scored by Marco. And the film continues the story of a family forced to navigate a world inhabited by blind aliens with heightened hearing. Best not make too much noise then. I think it's probably safe to say. Now, plenty to discuss with John and Marco in a moment. But first, a word from our very, very good friends at Grass & Co. Now, if you're a regular listener to Soundtrack and you'll have heard me talking about this brand quite a lot, that's because I'm a genuine fan of the products. And I wanted to clear a few things up for some of you who might not be aware of what CBD is and what its benefits are. The CBD stands for, apologies if I always get this wrong, cannabidiol, which is a natural extract of the hemp plant, but it's both legal and non-intoxicating. Grass & Co. are a premium CBD range of the finest quality, sustainably sourced and blended with complementary botanical ingredients like chamomile, ginger, turmeric and ashwagandha, which not only make it taste nice, but help relax your mind and soothe your body. Now, why do I use it? Well, to be frank, it just makes my day a little bit easier. I find it helps me with things like anxiety, with stress and definitely with sleeping. So maybe now's the time for you to give CBD a go. And if so, well, I can highly recommend Grass & Co. products. Now, there are three ranges, Calm, Rest and Ease. And I'm particularly fond of the Calm range, which also comes with complementary products like aromatherapy candles, pillow sprays, or great for any muscle issues, their CBD balm. They're all there to help you with your daily routine, bringing a touch of tranquility to whatever lays ahead for you. Grass & Co. CBD oils contain no trace of THC. All the CBD products are totally legal to buy, consume and supply in the UK. Interested? Well, find your Calm with 25% off plus free shipping at grassandco.com/sound. That's grassandco.com/sound. All you need to do to use that discount code is use the word sound at checkout to claim your 25% off the Grass & Co. Calm, Ease and Rest CBD ranges. So visit grassandco.com/sound and use the discount code sound at checkout to claim 25% off the entire Grass & Co. ranges. And so to John with Marco to follow afterwards. Now we'll begin with one of the latter's cues from A Quiet Place Part 2, encouraging feedback.
Thank you. Edith. How are you doing?
I'm really good. I'm so glad I got this. I'm in my car. I'm just going to tell you straight away.
I can tell. Thank you for being honest. But sadly, I knew before you told me.
It's not a green screen of a car. It's an actual car. So, yeah. Listen, congratulations on this latest chapter of A Quiet Place. It was absolutely just the perfect film to reacquaint myself with the cinema. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that. Honestly, I mean, people coming out to see our movie is so thrilling, but equally thrilling, if not more so, is that people are coming out at all to back to the theater. So thank you for saying that.
It's the gift that keeps on giving in terms of there's so many emotions that you've been able to deliver within this film. Was that part of the aim of this film, not really sitting in one category, of it fulfilling lots of different things?
I think so. I mean, I think for me, probably where that comes from is I didn't want to do a sequel at all. I mean, to me, a sequel, I was very fearful, as I'm sure a lot of people were, that sequels are often made just for sequel's sake. And
yeah,
this first movie was so incredibly special to me and so incredibly personal. I know I've said it before and it sounds bizarre, but it was a love letter to my kids. And so I didn't know how I'd be able to tell as personal and as organic a story as that. So what ended up happening was I told them to go make another or make it with someone else. But the one idea I kept thinking of is, if you made Millie the lead character of the movie, what does that do? And it mm-hmm. opens up a whole door of storytelling that I was really interested in exploring. Not only do I think that she's one of the more brilliant actors I've ever worked with and is able to hold a franchise, but she's also the continuation of all the metaphors and themes that we were dealing with. This idea of family and parenthood and being bolder and more courageous than the generation in front of you. All that stuff was possible once I had that idea. And really, it was thinking about working with Millie in that way that made me want to do the second one.
So it was that idea then. I was going to ask you, who or what made you change your mind, really?
Her being the lead, again, allowed me to continue the metaphors, which was so key to me. And then all of a sudden, the storyline started opening, which is, if you have Millie, you get to experience the other parts of the world, because she's brave enough to walk off the path and actually take this story and this, you know, the answer that she found in the first movie, she's brave enough to take it to the rest of the world, even though it may be dangerous and treacherous. And I think that allowed you to have a cast member like Cillian Murphy. You got to have people who were experiencing the world in a very different way and in a very understandable way. I mean, what Cillian is a morally ambiguous character who very rightly feels that he doesn't want to go on. He has given up on life because he's suffered a tremendous loss. He's going through an extremely dark time that the rest of the world is going through. And very much like humanity, it's tempting to give up when times get really hard. And that idea of thinking of Millie being the inspiration for someone else to start again and give life another shot was extremely moving for me.
And I love that passing down of that as well, and the fact that she kind of got that inspiration from your character, you know, her dad, this beautiful relationship that they had, which we get to see, you know, at the start of the film. And we kind of see where her strength and her drive kind of come, the seed of it comes from, really. Which
That's
is
exactly
gorgeous.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, to me, you know, I had always been told don't work with kids because they never know their lines. They cost you too much time and all those things. And I got the exact opposite experience. I mean, if you think about it, these kids at the time were 13 and 14, and they are not only able to sort of hold ideas in their head like deep loss and shame and the guilt of a parent blaming them for the loss of a sibling and stuff in the first movie. They weren't only able to hold it in their heads, they were able to articulate it through a performance. And so when you unleash that in the second movie and you have this girl realize that not only did her father not love her, he loved her more than anything and wished for her to be better than him. And that's exactly what she does in the second movie. She takes everything that he taught her and does so much more with it than he even thought he could.
Oh man, you're going to make me cry properly, like every hair. So, but that's the thing, is there's, you really care about this family. You really, you know, that's, you've done this brilliant thing where you've made us all just love this family and want the best for them. And we want to know that they're okay. And we want to know that they're looking out for each other. And there's so much soul and so much truth, I think, in that family dynamic that you wrote in the first that continues in this one as well.
Thank you for saying that. That was absolutely what we were going for. And I think that's certainly what I've learned, especially in this latest wave of genre. Everybody always says that there's this new category of genre, but I think that in genre, I remember a good friend of mine, Drew Goddard, who's a genius, and he wrote The Martian and then directed and wrote Bad Times at the El Royale, things like that. I remember he was the one who said, the beauty of genre is it keeps the audience at an arm's length, but in a good way. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, if you're a child of divorce, Kramer versus Kramer might be really intense for you. It might feel too real. Whereas a movie like E.T. allows this mysticism that allows you to deal with divorce, but in a way that you're more open and more vulnerable. And I thought that was genius, clearly genius enough to steal his his genius in other interviews. But it's really what I found. I think that you watch a movie like Get Out and what that is able to deal with in such a palpable, eviscerating way because of genre, or a love story like Let the Right One In. I don't know if I've seen a love story as good as that in recent, you know, time, because yes, because you're sort of triggered by these two children who fall in love and one of them is a vampire, you're allowed to go with it. You allow your soul and your brain to kind of go with this mysticism. And that's what I love most about genre.
That's a good film night right there. All those films that you just...
I know, I agree, right? There we go.
Yeah, I'm there, totally. listen, I had the absolute pleasure of chatting to your composer a couple of days ago, Marco, and it was really fascinating talking to him about the journey between these two films with the score and the music. And also, I think another thing is that, and what was interesting as well, that he talked about something that he's learned over the years is to build that relationship between the composer and the sound team and how important that can be. And this film is a great example of that, because you give us a very short moment within the first film where we get the perspective from Regan's character, from Millie's character there. But with this, it's kind of, it's heightened and you really are there and it physically kind of jolts you. It's so powerful.
That was one of my favorite experiences of this whole process. That actually came from a moment on set that I was talking to Millie's mother. And I said to Millie's mom, I said, is Millie completely deaf or can she hear at all? And she said, she actually can. I remember she called it an envelope. She said, it's almost like she's in an envelope. There's a soft rumbling sound to her and she might not be able to hear you speak, but she can hear a loud car door or you know, a big bang behind her. And so I brought that to the sound team and I said, we have to do that. We have to bring the audience into this envelope that Millie's mom was talking about. And we worked really hard on it. It was one of the things I'm most proud of. And then at the premiere of the movie, which was an emotional night for everybody, I remember Millie's mom came up to me and she was weeping. And I remember thinking, wow, I'm so glad she liked the movie. And she said, no, the movie was great, but I have to tell you that all my life, the only thing I've been praying for every day is to understand my daughter's experience that she goes through every single day. And for the first time in my life, I got to experience that thanks to you. And so she said, I'll never be able to thank you for that. And I burst into tears. And I said, well, I thank you are the one who inspired. But that kind of organic connectivity between real life and this cast and this movie is what made this whole thing so magical. And it makes me tear up every time I talk about it.
No, you're about, it's the second time in the 8 minutes, John. This is ridiculous. Stop now. With the score, before we talk about the score, that you have this brilliant thing where within each film we have one needle drop. So you have the Neil Young track in the first film, and then we have Beyond the Sea in this one. How did you come to the decisions of those songs? And in particular, Beyond the Sea, the particular version that you were going to use. You know, there's so many versions of that song.
Yes.
But yeah, what was the kind of... the decision-making process in those songs?
Well, Beyond the Sea, I'm a nerd for tracking logic. And what I loved about that was it was one of the first ideas I had. Once I realized that the odyssey for Millie's character would be to take this weapon that she realized she had and bring it to the rest of the world, that she was selfless and that she was going to try to help the rest of the world. Where would the rest of the world be safe? And I remember thinking, well, if they're on an island, then they'd be safe. And how would you get to communicate that to people? Well, you wouldn't have someone sitting in a room all day, every day, talking out to the rest of the world. You'd try to find some clue to give the rest of the world that you could leave on repeat. And that's where I came up with the idea of Beyond the Sea. And I'm a huge Bobby Darin fan. He's probably one of, if not my favorite artist to listen to, that sort of takes me away and calms me down.
Beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, My lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing.
And then in the first movie, the Neil Young song, I remember that song's been a favorite of mine forever, but it was the first dance wedding song to our dear friends. And I remember when they shared that with me, it was just a foregone conclusion that I had to use it in the movie. And then I think that what happened, one of my favorite stories of the first movie was when Emily and I started to do that. I remember Cameron Crowe on his set used to play music out loud. And I never thought I'd be bold enough and or good enough to play a song live through speakers on set. And when we did, it was sort of halfway through the shoot and we played that in the basement. And I think that really was the moment I realized how lucky I was to do this movie with my wife, not only because she's a tremendous actress and the best in the business, in my opinion, but because that's where we really got to play with that secret language that I wasn't even sure we had. And that scene to me is the articulation of the secret language between two people who very luckily are in love and going through a difficult time. And so that scene became much more magical than just two people dancing. And I remember looking around and I could tell which members of the crew were in a relationship because they were tearing up. And it was really a beautiful moment.
Come a little bit closer, hear what I have to say. Just like children sleeping, we could dream this night away.
Isn't it amazing how powerful music can be to do that?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And I think that it can change the inner workings of your body in a split second. I mean, I think right now, if either you or I played a song that meant so much to us right now, we would feel it. You would almost feel that story behind the song.
It's almost like almost a time machine as well, can't it? So there'll be a particular song that you can hear that you might not have heard for 10 years, but as soon as you hear the first two notes of that song, you are immediately taken back to that moment that it meant the most.
Exactly right.
Amazing. Let's talk about Marco before we run out of time, because I loved chatting to him and the score is extraordinary and it does so many things, because it heightens that kind of, you know, the terrifying nature of the creatures and when they're arriving and all that kind of thing, yeah. As well. But also the emotional side of it. And there was one cue in particular where Killian's characters, when he's on the beach and he's looking at the picture of his son.
Yes.
And it's actually a really uplifting and beautiful piece.
Yes.
But it could have been almost, you know, cry.
Right.
And it does, but in a very different way. And yeah. So I was just interested to learn about the conversations that you had with Marco, particularly because, you know, these two films and how the score moved and I guess kind of progressed from the first film to the second as well.
Well, I think that what we talked about in the first movie for sure was tonally, we understood that it needed to be able to deliver tension, right? It was going to be another character in the movie. That music, I said, I wanted the music to almost be a shepherd for the family, that it would not be ahead of the family, but it would be behind them. It would always be behind them, guiding you through what their experience was, rather than tipping your hat, because I think that's the worst thing that can happen in genre is that you give it away with sound or music. And he really understood that. And then we started talking more esoterically about things like, I just said, what I want is to get that sense that this family is actually losing the memory of music, that it's been so long. Think about, if you can't hear any music whatsoever, would you start to forget it? And I remember he loved that idea of the elements of music breaking down and you not even remembering if that's how the song really went. And so all this stuff became more discordant and more broken down into pieces, which was really thrilling. And I think nobody can score an anxiety attack quite like Marco. I think what he's able to do. I don't know if you've seen the movie Score. If you haven't, it's beautiful. But when you see his laboratory up there in the hills, he's able to create all this stuff because he feels the world in that very specific way, which we are lucky to tap into.
It's really interesting knowing when to score like the tension parts, like knowing when to score a jump scare and knowing when not to as well. And also, how do you write a jump scare?
You don't. I mean, the truth is, I mean, you really don't. I remember sitting down to write the first movie and I thought, how am I ever going to write a scary movie? I didn't even watch scary movies as a kid. I certainly did a lot of research before I did this one, but, and I realized actually the biggest lesson I learned was on The Office, which was the head of the show, Greg Daniels. He came up to me one day because I was basically quaking at my desk and he said, is everything all right? And I said, yeah, I said, this is my favorite. I think it was like 3 weeks into shooting. It was probably our second episode. And I said, this is my favorite joke in the script. I want to make sure I deliver it funny for you. And he said, whoa, you don't deliver anything funny. You just deliver it honestly. And if people think it's funny, that's up to them. And if people think your line is sad, that's up to them. You just deliver it honestly. And I thought, wow, I've taken that with me through my whole career. And when I sat down to write the first movie, that's exactly what I did. I wrote a movie about a family. And so the jump scares really came because I wrote about a family living believably under this set of circumstances. And the scares all of a sudden started writing themselves because you didn't want to see this family in peril. And so anytime this family got separated, the tension went up and all of a sudden you found a jump scare presenting itself perfectly because you didn't want anything to happen to this family that you fell in love with.
That's so interesting because it's so effective.
Thank you very much.
I've actually levitated a couple of times watching this one. It's so good. Who decided that strings would be terrifying in the world of scoring as well? Strings are just most terrifying, that kind of quivering strings. It's like they just are kind of, they're making your fists clench as they're kind of playing. It's like,
no, absolutely. And I thought that, you know, I remember talking to Marco too about the emotionality of each character. And so, you know, you mentioned that moment of Killian on the beach. And if you go back and watch the movie again, that piece of music is actually introduced the first time that you meet Killian, but it's only introduced with one part. There's only the high strings are with Killian, but the cello doesn't come in till much later because the cello all of a sudden is his transformation and his redemption instrument. And so by the end of the movie, these tiny little pieces that we had introduced in the beginning come back in the end with him. And it's sort of when he's getting his whole, you know, perspective on the world back.
When you were, can you remember going into the first film and if there were any specific scores that were inspiring to you in terms of how in your head you heard A Quiet Place sounding? Were there any inspirations for you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I remember first and foremost, which I'm sure almost everybody's heard, but Arvo Part, you know, that whole Spiegel, I'm Spiegel thing. And that breaking down of one instrument, two instruments, three instruments, and having each instrument take the lead. I remember that was really influential to me. If for no other reason, the handoff idea, that idea that an instrument would hand off and become dominant and the other instrument that you loved in the piece previous becomes, you know, in the background and more decrescendoed. And I love that whole idea. And then as far as scores go, there's so many scores that I have loved, from, you know, The Mission, that score is pretty flawless, to even like Let the Right One In recently. I love when scores are scary, but still delicate, that there's an idea of fragility to the whole thing. That's what moves me. Thank you.
And that idea that you were talking about with your films of them not, you know, being like most travelers, you get at airports, of kind of taking you into the emotion of it kind of just being over your shoulder to
That's
wait
exactly
till
right.
experienced it.
Yes.
Absolutely. Are we getting a third?
We are getting a third. Only because you asked. Only because you asked. No, we have a tremendous, I'm so lucky to have a filmmaker that I think is one of the best out there right now. Jeff Nichols has agreed to do the third installment. And so Jeff Nichols is one of my favorite directors and writers. He's done so many good movies, but the movie most recently that I was sort of thinking of when I asked him to do it was Mud. I think that he has that ability to write unbelievably specific and heartbreaking characters that you fall in love with. And so I am excited to see the magic he cooks up in this one.
I'm kind of, it's a double-edged sword because I'm excited, but I'm also, you're stepping back from that kind of that role in it. So yeah, it must
I'll
be
a part of it as much as he wants me to be. I mean, it's a team sport for sure. I mean, the Quiet Place world is, we're lucky to have everyone that's involved be so in love with it. So it's kind of like summer camp. So as much as he wants me around, I'll be there.
Could someone get John off set, please?
Yeah, exactly. This is embarrassing for you, John. Get out of here.
Listen, it's so great to chat to you. Thank you so much for your patience as well with this whole setup and stuff. And,
are you kidding? This is great. I love the car the car podcast, the car cast.
And yeah, congratulations again, John. Brilliant, brilliant.
Thank
stuff.
You so Thank much. You. It was so nice
Take
to talk
care.
To you. See ya.
Stay safe. Bye-bye.
From the score to A Quiet Place 2, that's Mother and Child by Marco Beltrami, rounding off this first part of Soundtracking with John Krasinski. And I have to thank John for being so generous and accommodating, considering I did the interview in my car. And so to the man who composed that cue himself, Marco. Now we'll begin this next section of the podcast with another of his compositions, A Grateful Family. Marco.
Hello, Edith.
Listen, I had the fabulous experience of having my first trip back into the cinemas and watching A Quiet Place 2 last week.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And that's exactly where you need to see it, is in cinemas with those sound systems and having the whole experience. So great.
Well, I'm looking forward to that myself because I never got a chance to see the final thing all put together because you know, they were mixing in New York and I was in LA and they had like a final playback and it was just the beginning. It was like February of 2020, something like that. And mm-hmm. I was just hearing stories about the virus. I'm like, I don't know if I want to go, you know.
Yeah.
So I stayed home. So I'm going to go see it myself. I'm going to take the family and see it this weekend.
I love that. That must be yeah. quite a rare thing, though, for you to have that, where you're not obviously coming in cold to it, but you're kind of, you get to have to be the fan watching the whole experience.
Well, yeah, I mean, we'll see if all the music's in the right place.
Oh, it is. It's yeah, okay. it really, really is. I wanted to. I guess this is. I don't know. Well, tell me if it's a unique opportunity where you work across a sequel of a film, and whether there is, how much connection there is between the two films, how much is there any repetition, is there any, you know, kind of progression and journey for cues from one to the next?
There's a lot of connection. I mean, it's I don't know if you saw the first, but it's the same world, it's the same cinematic world. The difference in this movie, without giving anything away, is that they venture out, they leave the home, they leave the farm. So it has a little bit more of an adventure film to it, but it really is the same world. And so it's the same thematic material that I developed in first, and I got to expand here. It's the same palette. You know, I did a few things a little bit differently. In the first movie, I had a piano that had just the black notes detuned a quarter step. On this, I actually took a whole piano and detuned it a quarter step. So, you know, just expanding a little bit on the things that that we worked on in the first one. And yeah, it is nice to work on a sequel.
Is it?
It is nice to. Yeah, it is, because it's a chance to, you know, the material's established. It's a chance to let the wings flap a little, you know, and let it play out a little bit more. And there's a comfort level with everybody. There's a comfort level on the part of the filmmakers and everything when they are actually using the first movie to temp for the second one. There's a little bit of that uncertainty that they always have in movies with the music. There's a familiarity with it. So it makes it the dialogue a lot less abstract and more tangible.
Well, there's kind of almost sort of, there's just two extremes that I love about your score for these films is the kind of really experimental side of it that kind of represents the kind of, you know, the fear and the kind of running and the kind of tension of it. And then this beautiful kind of palette of strings and love and, you know, kind of going to the ends of the earth for your family kind of vibe that you get from all these beautiful cues that you write for that side of it. It's these kind of two extremes, and they work so well, and it's so powerful as well, because it, particularly in the opening sort of moments of the new film, because it opens with sound before we see anything. So it puts you in a state. You know, music has that ability to transport you immediately, just with one note even, or a vibration. And that's what this does so cleverly, is that you hear this kind of, I mean, I'm not sure how you created it, but it's kind of got a sort of drone element to it. but you hear that before you see anything. So it puts you in a kind of an emotional state before you've even seen anything. It's so clever.
You're getting me excited to go see it here. Well, thank you. First of all, thank you. That's very kind of you to say such nice things. I mean, there is a big ideological balance between this more acoustical orchestral palette for the human parts, the family, the thematic elements of the father-daughter theme and the family theme, and contrasting that with the more manipulated electronic parts of the monster stuff and the alien part. And I think what, and the suspense, and also basically the narrative, which, you know, keeps it in the realm of suspense. And the overall idea for this was that at the heart, this is a family movie. It's so well acted and it's so well put together that the way it is scary is because you really feel for the characters and you're invested in their safety and their well-being. And that way you can actually play with really minimal ideas, especially when it's a very neutral canvas sonically, and anything you do becomes highlighted in a way. So it's a unique opportunity in that.
And it's really interesting as well within that kind of sonic canvas that you have this necessary perspective from Regan, you know, this hard sonic perspective of silence, you know, in terms of what that's like for Hart, you know, and we see that within the sort of first act of this new film. And it's and that in itself of the kind of the side, you know, the immediate kind of, you're transported to her perspective and to, you know, she can see what's going on, but in terms of sonically, that's such a kind of essential thing to do because it makes you kind of sort of check in with yourself.
Well, it makes you identify with her plight. You know, it's not just watching her distractedly or, you know, from a third person, but it almost puts you in a sympathetic place where you can, you know, identify a little bit with her, which I think, you know, John does an amazing job at in the movie.
He's very good, isn't he? He's very good.
Yeah.
He's very good. He's done a great job. Again, you know, these two films I love. They're so, I think someone said about them being genre defined, and they really are because they, you know, they're love stories, they're horrors, they're kind of action films. There's so many things, they really are. It's very clever.
Which is great. I mean, the whole notion of genre, I don't really care for. I mean, stories are stories. They should be able to, they shouldn't just fit in one world. And so the fact that this brings attention to the fact that they can, you know, a movie can work in many levels and be entertaining, but also make you feel something deeper. I think is really great, and what a great way to sort of open theaters up too.
Oh, totally. I'm hoping. I think I'm going to get to speak to John next week because I'm so intrigued of how you write a jump scare, or how you direct a jump scare. Because I came, my heart was racing so many times during this film. It's so. And I really craved it. You know, that kind of thing of you. I remember, you know, being a kid with the kind of cushion ready when you were watching a film at home sort of thing. And you knew there was going to be scary moments and you almost kind of craved that. And I think I wanted this first cinema experience back to be everything I love about cinema. And this film was so much of what I love about cinema. It really was.
Yeah, I know. It's definitely true.
I've got a couple of specific cues from the new film that I apologize now for how I describe them because I'm not familiar enough with the score titles and stuff yet. And I'm hoping that you recognize them from my description, even though you've not seen the film in its final form. But okay. there's a couple, but when she kind of near the beginning of the film, after we've sort of had Regan's perspective and she has the watch, and there's a really gorgeous cue there. And that's the really interesting thing, that your music does so much for the narrative because of the lack of words and conversation at certain parts of the film.
Well, I'm pretty sure that if it's the cue that it's supposed to be there, that you know, it's so that's the thematic representation of the father-daughter theme, which is very spare, right? And I remember when I started working on the film back on the first movie, there was just a couple pieces that John mentioned to me that were inspirational to him, pieces of music. And one was a specific piece. The other was this composer, Avo Part. And when he mentioned that, I wasn't sure at the time how it fit in. But as I got to watching the film, and this, by the way, one of the reasons I don't like to read scripts, because I would never pick this up from reading the script, but it's in the intimate details of the performance, of her performance, and the emotion of it, that you don't want to overplay, but you want to be poignant. And so having this sparse piano, I think we used harp, I'm not sure what's used in this case, but it could be the piano harmonics that started. And I thought that it would somehow capture this very tenuous, delicate relationship that she has with her father.
And it's lovely because that kind of goes right through to the end, where I think Emmett kind of says, you know, something along the lines of, there's so much of him, you know, you're him, basically, you know, and it's almost kind of that kind of journey, and that cue kind of feels like it has a kind of beautiful journey throughout the whole film in a weird way.
Okay.
There's a cue called Show Me Your Face that I loved as well. When you're starting with a piece like that, are you starting from, like you say, like from the emotional necessity of the characters and the story and the narrative?
Yes. Now, the interesting thing about that spot is that I tried a couple things, because I had a theme for Emmett as well. And this is sort of an emotional scene for him too. He's made a journey on this as well. And I originally thought, well, I'll play it with his theme. But after watching it, it's like the thing is really about, it's really about her fundamentally. So that seemed to be a bigger picture. And he was fitting into her world there as well. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes you toy around with these things.
And
musically, both ways would have worked. In terms of the bigger picture, I think the... And this is a discussion also that I have with John about what we play here. So that's, you know, these are the things that you figure out along the way, discussing with the director and keeping it a collaborative affair.
And then there's Emmett's realizations And it feels like there's almost a kind of certain palette of sounds for his character in particular, you know, in terms of where there's cues that are coming in to reflect his story, his emotions, his narrative, his journey, that there are certain instrumentation, I guess, is my kind of non-musical way of trying to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, so again, it's all part of the same acoustical world of the other characters, but yeah, and this is where I'll have to actually watch and see for myself, because I know there was, for the Emmett scenes, we had a couple different ideas, so what is finally in the picture, I'll be really curious to see.
I love it. I love that you don't know. It's like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
There's a couple of ones that you will know from the first film that I allowed myself the luxury of just listening to the soundtrack from the first film. And it's so great. It was really lovely to go back and, you know, I hadn't watched the film in a while. I watched the film again and then I just sat with the soundtrack and it was so great to have on and listen to. And I love A Quiet Life. It goes on an amazing journey just as a piece of music.
Yeah, I mean, that was the, I think that was the first thing I wrote for the whole series, you know, and that was inspired by John telling me that one of the things that he was listening to when he was working on movie right from the very beginning was this cover of David Bowie's Heroes song, and so I listened to the song and thought about how it related and what it was that made this applicable piece for the movie, and mm-hmm. so that was the original thematic idea for the whole series.
Wow. And the kids' bonfire cue as well is just another favorite of mine.
Right. Yeah, that was a fun scene to do. You're bringing back memories now.
Am I? Happy ones and good ones, I hope, Mark.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Also the kind of the choice of there's one more cue in the first film, A Quiet Moment. You know, you talked about the kind of, I don't know what the correct term is, but you had the black notes you tuned down or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that these people have been without music. They've been without things for a long time. It's almost like the without sound. And it's almost like their impression of what music was, their memory of maybe beginning to fade a little bit, you know, on a very abstract level. And that was something I was like, oh, well, how can we do that? I can't detune the whole orchestra because it'll sound like out of tune. But if you can actually just take a few notes and give the hint of that, that might be enough.
I know we kind of got a little bit of time left, so I hope you don't mind if I talk a little bit about some of the work that you've done with James Mangold as well, who I was lucky enough to have on the
show. Oh wow!
On the show.
He's amazing director.
I love being in his company. I was lucky enough to host a couple of
me too.
Days. he's got this infectious energy that's just
And he's so musically like savvy. Like, I mean, I have to say, working with Jim, I sort of listen to music in a different way. You know, the whole way that he wants the scoring sessions to be less precise, less polished, like sort of rough around the edges approach. You know, there's something to that. You know, you hear that, you get the actual performance of humans as opposed to, you know, being a slick polished thing. It's been tremendous having him to work for.
He made me cry when I interviewed him, because he told me this incredible story about when he was before and then after filming Walk the Line, and this relationship that he'd built up with Johnny Cash, and that he would have these phone calls with him every Saturday morning, and that Johnny Cash's daughter kind of told James that he would just wait for the phone to ring on a Saturday morning. He'd kind of wait for James's call, sort of thing. And I was like, God, I was bawling my eyes out when he told me that story. It's so beautiful, so lovely. Yeah. Logan is one of my favorite films of James's, just in terms of, you know, I think that idea of these characters and their world and how he flipped it on its head and made this just sort of beautiful film. I thought it was stunning. What do you remember about working on Logan with him?
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. I love that movie. And again, the fact that, you know, this was a superhero movie, but we could totally take it in a new direction, and that he really captained the ship to go in this sort of alternate direction with the music and championed this approach was so refreshing. And the fact that we were able to experiment and try things that may not have been ordinary, you know, it made it into such a great experience. And I think the end result is you have a very special, unique film.
That main theme gets me every time. There's two of my favorites, the main theme and Eliminator, it's called. which is
we had a lot of puns on words. We, you know, you spend too much time in a studio by yourself, you start making your own puns.
A hell of a piece of music. That it's just the string, the piano, and the trumpet, and it's great. It would be impossible to think that we could even really skim the surface of the work that you've done as a composer. You know, when you look down the list of projects that you've worked on, and a number of documentaries as well, which is something that I wanted just to touch on in terms of if it's a different approach to working on a documentary as opposed to a feature.
Well, it is. And it isn't. My process of writing is similar. I get the inspiration from what I am seeing on the screen and finding a through line that it connects the picture throughout. And I think one of the differences that in a documentary, you tend to have a lot of voiceover stuff that goes throughout. And it's integral to the telling of the doc. And so in those cases, you have to be supportive, and the function of the music might be a little bit different in that, in those spaces. But in the end, you know, like when you have the bigger moments, the thematic moments, I think it's very similar to scoring a dramatic picture.
I guess with some projects and directors, you have the ability to experiment more with some than you do with others. And I know, and I was privy to a wonderful story about the recording of some of the work for Holmes Way, and, you know, or recording your orchestra outside and just experimenting with how you create sound and, you know, bringing in other elements to, you know, to manipulate it and things like that. Is that part of the fun for you in terms of?
Definitely. I mean, every project is unique. Finding out the needs of it, finding out what the crux of the picture is to me, that's the puzzle. That's solving, cracking the puzzle is really what I love about it. And, you know, in that movie, The Homesman, Buck, my partner in the studio, and I, we really wanted to experiment with the wind. The wind was almost like a character in the movie. And it's what's causing these people to go crazy out, you know, the homesteaders in the turn of the century. And so being able to tune the wind and make it actually a character in the movie was turning this non-musical thing into a musical element was part of the fun of that.
Thank you.
And I love the explorations of doing that. And if you have a director that supports you in the on this creative journey and of exploration, like Tommy Lee Jones did, and that it makes the process that much more fun because you're involving everybody in it.
Yeah. I wish Catherine Bigelow would make more films more regularly because, you know, the Heart Locker, I know she's always trying to make films. And I know that this industry is such a, you know, it's a hard one to kind of get things kind of through, I guess. But the Heart Locker, which is, God, it's like 2008 now, I think, as well, was a phenomenal film.
Well, that movie, that was an interesting movie, too, because that totally revolutionized my idea of how music and sound work together in a movie. Up until that point, I think probably I always viewed the sound department as my adversary a little bit. And you're competing for the same space in the final mix. But that's the picture where I, you know, really saw that music and sound work together to create this, the emotional underpinning of the film. They're not combatants, but they should work hand in hand. And that's when I started to really work closely with the sound department.
Is that because you learned whilst you were making that film? Was that something she kind of encouraged in terms of the collaboration element, or?
That was something that, when we started out on that film, she only wanted two cues of music. There was only two spots. But little by little, as we experimented, because one of the things that we tried to do was make the sonic textures to manipulate the audience, to heighten the awareness, the reality there without really the audience being able to know what it was. And it began to work more and more. And so it turned into a full-fledged score. We started, you know, asking the sound guys what they were doing and taking some of their elements and giving them what we were doing. And there became a dialogue between us. And that was really the first time that happened.
And then you come to sort of to now with something like A Quiet Place, and that relationship is so important.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And yeah, if I hadn't had the Hurt Locker experience, you know, the Quiet Place may have turned out differently. So, you know, it's funny how your life is a progression and things feed other things, and it's all, everything doesn't exist in a vacuum at all, sort of.
Yeah.
Lends itself to a bigger process.
And being open to learning, you know, and developing as well, and having an open mind to your role being something different to what you expect it to be or understand it to be as well.
Exactly.
Last one, I promise, before I leave you, and I know that there's about another 500 that we could talk about, but back to Mr. Mangold, because 310 to Yuma is a film that I was it about 3 weeks ago. It was on Film 4 here in the UK, and I was just like I fist pumped the air. I was like, yes, I love that film. And I guess that's
me
the
too.
You know, there's the expectation for, you know, we go back to when we were talking earlier about genre defying and about how it is a genre film, but it's not as well. And I think that I just think that there were ways that James and his creative team, you included in that, kind of not fought against that, but encouraged that in a way. Would you agree?
Oh, totally. That was such a great, I loved that movie. What was so much fun for me, besides from, you know, just the movie as a whole, is that everything was sort of anachronistic. Like it all took place, you know, in the late, you know, 1800s, but the movie was very modern in a way. And so musically, I thought, wow, well, what if we used only instruments that could have been around in that time period, but we treated them in a very modern way? So, you know, we had like a tack piano that we actually outfitted with tacks, like a saloon piano. And we had, you know, we only used acoustic guitars and percussion instruments. We used like, I think the chimes from grandfather clock and all kinds of things like that. But then we manipulated, you know, Buck and I treated everything so the guitars sound, they can sound electric by the way we process them, or the piano, we could filter it out. So it became, you know, very percussive and became the sounds of it could be very modern, but yet it was rooted in this tradition, this, even if it was a fake tradition. And I think that really was a fun process, you know, to embark on.
Listen, they haven't seen it, or they haven't seen it in a while, go and treat yourself to a screening of 3:10 to Yuma. It's a great experience. Listen, we've run out of time, but I'm excited because you're working with Andy Serkis, or you may have finished working on Venom with Andy Serkis. I love Andy. I think he's a wonderful human being.
Yeah, I met him. It was hard. We were working through COVID times.
Wow.
I did finally meet him face to face when he came out for a screening of Playback at Sony. And I want to spend more time with the guy. I could tell he's, you know, I'd love to hang out with him, and he's great to work with. And I love his ideas, and he made a great movie. So it's, I think that's coming out sometime in the fall.
Great. Well, hopefully maybe we can have some more time to talk about your brilliant work, Marco. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Edith. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
It's been great. Enjoy the rest of your day, and I wish you well.
Thank you. You too.
From the score to A Quiet Place Part 2, that's Regan
on her own. Rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with Marco Beltrami and John Krasinski. My huge thanks to Marco and John for taking the time to talk to us. A Quiet Place 2 is on general release now, and as I said earlier, fully deserves to be seen and heard in a cinematic setting. Head to edithbowman.com to find a link to a Spotify playlist for the show, featuring the music that we play in the order it appears. My website is also the place to catch up with every single episode of the podcast, and please subscribe if you haven't already. Now, we're on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And do check out our little YouTube channel too, where I put together sort of sporadic shows of the great and good from the world of film, music and television. Next up then, we continue in the vein of having lovely chats with directors and their composers. A film that's due to hit cinemas over the next couple of weeks, Supernova, starring Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth. It is written and directed by Harry McQueen and composed by the fabulous Keaton Henson. Harry and Keaton join me next week on Soundtrackin'. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.